my name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic. You want this guy?
Leave it.
Oh, this is a recorder. Man, Blue Ridge Speakers Group. I love it. This is spectacular. So happy to be here, Dan the alcoholic, and that was not an easy thing for me to say. I guess it was, you know, almost about 8 years ago when I came in this time around, and it was June of 2011. I got reintroduced. I don't even want to say reintroduced, but kind of reintegrated back into AA because I was terrified of what the future held if I continued on the path that I was going. But I wasn't so terrified that I was going to go to AA of my own volition, like my own, you know, goodwill, or like, you know, I didn't like wake up like, today's the day, man. I am probably an alcoholic, and if I keep drinking, I'm going to die. I should go to a meeting. What really happened was I had a girl that I was sleeping with who lived across the street from me, and she was going to AA, and she was like, you should go to a meeting with me, and I was like, all right, man, maybe I'll help you get sober, and that's how, that was no joke my attitude, and my actual thought process, and I went to that meeting, and of course I that was the last beer I ever drank in my life. I think it was either a Busch. My neighbor liked to drink Busch or Milwaukee's Best. I think it was a Busch. I had a Busch, and she like caught me off guard. So I finished the Busch, and I was kind of like, all right, I'll be okay, because I didn't think you should go to AA meetings drunk. That was my opinion at that time. But I'll tell you right now, from being in AA and going to a lot of meetings over the last 7 years, we welcome drunk people, 100%. But I did think that I should do something to alter my state of mind, because I was going to go to an AA meeting, and that sounded very uncomfortable. So I took some pain pills, and I ate those, and I went to this meeting to just kind of get me a little, just so I could have some security, you know, because I was a guy, you know, from the youngest, you know, that I can remember, I was always looking for security. And what that is how am I going to feel safe and how am I going to feel good? So I was always looking for that. So I had, you know, took those pills, went to that meeting, and I identified in that meeting. And, you know, it's what our book, you know, talks about. You know, talks about that. Really, there's like that window of like opportunity that we have, that like willingness. It's just pure desperation is what it is, man. It's a gift. And I had it then without knowing it. When I got to that meeting, I was able to identify. It's hard to identify when I think I know things or I think I have answers. And at that time, I knew I didn't have anything. And what got me there was, you know, I'd just gotten out of jail. I was 28 at the time. And, you know, I came from a pretty, you know, good family, a good town in Washington, D.C. We actually grew up just outside of D.C. and Chevy Chase, Maryland. But, like, I was conflicted as a kid, man, because Chevy Chase is, like, where the rich people were from, and I wasn't rich, you know. So I was like, man, this is weird. I'm not really a Chevy Chase kid. Like, I don't go to a country club. You know, both my parents work. Like, I have a babysitter. Like, and all my other, you know, friends, you know, their moms didn't work and stuff like that. So I was like, I'm from Friendship Heights, you know what I mean? And that's, like, the metro station there. And so that's how I identified. So I was, like, always conflicted. But, you know, that's not to say I had a bad upbringing. And I grew up with a lot of opportunity. Like, you know, I went to school. My parents paid for me to go to private school. They took care of me. Like, when things happened, they got me tutors. You know, I played sports. They bought me, you know, expensive sports equipment. I ended up playing lacrosse, which, you know, gets expensive because you got helmets and gear and pads. So I grew up, you know, fine. But, you know, internally, which is what the journey here is in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I always had that feeling, man, like it's just not going to be okay at some point. And living like that, you know, just it's a perfect setup for, you know, for drinking and drugs or whatever. And it's like, you know, someone tossed me that softball, man. And when I found a bottle, I was like, let's do it. And, you know, so the end of my drinking, I was like a DUI guy. That's what would always get me. I could not drink and drive. And it didn't matter how many DUIs I got. Didn't matter how bad the accident was. Like, I don't think it would have mattered if I killed anyone. Like, I think that's the truth. And I didn't kill anyone, and I didn't injure anyone severely, thank God. But, like, and that's, like, kind of the insanity and like, the disconnect that I have from reality when I, you know, put that into my system and what it does for me and how it shifts my thinking and my outlook on the world. And I was just a kid who didn't feel good, who wanted to feel good, man. That's the black and white of it. You know, if you, you know, I'm going to talk about a lot of stuff. I like to talk. I'm going to go off. I'm going to get opinionated. I'm going to say some curse words, and not like in a bad way. But if you get offended, I apologize. And I love what AA has done for me and for my life and for people I know, for my family. And it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, you know, hands down. And I wouldn't have said that 3 years ago. I wouldn't have said it 4 years ago. You know, it's taken time for me to kind of appreciate and see what actually happens here. But, you know, the first time I drank, and this is valid, you know, and I'll tell you this, I started searching for God or seeking for something when I was like 7 years old. And my dad beat the shit out of me at weird times. Like, I didn't think my dad was a bad guy, but he'd freak out. And I'd be like, what is this, man? Why are you freaking out? And I was like, why are you so mad at me? I'm like a 7-year-old kid. I just asked you for something. And so my response to that being in Catholic school was I started hearing about Jesus. They started teaching us about Jesus. And don't worry, I'm not going to talk about Jesus the whole meeting, so don't freak out. But I was like, man, Jesus is kind of cool. Like, it's this guy is like completely, the way I interpreted it as a 7-year-old was like, this guy's just walking around unfazed by all this stuff. And I was like, I want to be unfazed. Because I was fazed by a lot of things. A lot of things bothered me. And somehow I was like, all right, I'm going to go to church every day in the summer of 7th grade. I made my dad drive me to church. So that's, if I think about that now, that's an interesting thing. And you would think, at least I would think, if I saw a 7-year-old going to church every single day in the summer, like his like free time, like this is his summer to go like run around and do camps. And I did all that stuff too. I would think, well, maybe we have like a little Pope here, or, you know, what, like this guy has some calling. But really, you know, I can tell you now, I was just searching for some peace and relief, some grace, some help, man, because I was like uncomfortable. And that served its purpose. And this is funny how this plays out for that time. But then it would make me more uncomfortable because then the priest was like, you know, he's thinking it's a higher calling. So he's like, you should be an altar boy. And I was like, okay, I'll be an altar boy. And I become an altar boy. I was getting nervous when I started talking about being an altar boy priest of the Catholic Church. Like, everyone's like heart drops, like, oh no. Nothing happened, man. And so I become an altar boy, but that kind of makes me a little different because the guys who I'm in school with, that, you know, they're not altar boys yet, so I'm an early altar boy, so I'm like, you know, I'm like conflicted. I'm like, I don't want to be better than them, but I'm better than them, or they're going to think I'm a nerd or a God freak, and I'm trying to fit in. So there's all this discord. But, you know, sure enough, you know, the Catholic Church would solve that problem for me. And in like 7th grade, I was like, they got wine in that sacristy, man. And so I took that wine with my boy Paul, and we went and drank that wine. And that was like that, and that set the course for me. And I didn't have the spiritual awakening in which I was like, I found the answer for my life, or I found this relief. I'm doing this every day, anything like that. I was actually amazed at how drunk I got and how quick it happened. And I had, you know, I'd thrown up, I'd stole some cigarettes. You know, I'm 36, so this was like 90s, and cigarettes were just hanging out in the aisle. So I stole some cigarettes, blacked out, threw up. They went, and this is all in the matter of like 2.5 hours. I went back to my buddy's Paul's house, and his mom fed us some like soup. Ate some soup. My mom picked me up, and I was like, "No one's gonna say anything. Like this is all cool." And so I was like, "Man, I guess I can do this." And that was kind of like my thought: like I can do this and not get caught. It's not gonna be a big deal. Well, I was wrong about that because I would continue to do that, and it was usually before social events or dances with the opposite sex. And I would get nervous because, like, you know, like I told you, I just didn't feel like I fit in. It didn't matter that I was, you know, it didn't matter that I played sports. It didn't matter that I had friends. It didn't matter that I went to my friend's house. I just always felt different. So when they, you know, we'd go out to these dances and do all the stuff, I was like, you know, once I found out what alcohol did, I was like, all right, this is a perfect solution to these, you know, social, you know, events in which I'm going to feel less than, insecure and all that stuff. So I would drink it. And, man, dude, I literally got caught. I mean, that time, that story I just told you with the bottle of church wine was probably the only time, like, I really didn't get caught. I got caught all the time drinking. My high school, I was grounded, like, every other third month for 3 months. I mean, I could take up the whole, you know, whatever, 45 minutes I have of just telling you all the times I drank and got caught before I was 21 years old. And then there's 8 years of drinking from 21 to 29. And I got caught then, too, except it was by the cops. You know what I mean? So it just, you know, so it was like the signs were there, man. And, you know, our book talks about this, like, allergy. And I had the allergy in every way, shape, or form, man. Like, I could not drink safely. Just wasn't happening. However, though, I had the other part of it, too. And, I got that, like, the phenomenon of craving and the effect produced by alcohol. And I think, you know, I'm not going to get too opinionated, but the effect produced by alcohol for me is fascinating. I loved it. And so that's what, you know, I chased it down. But the kind of guy I was when I was, you know, when I was doing that, you know, it was, you know, just a kid who continued to find security and peace in what, you know, in areas that I couldn't. And, you know, I don't know why it was that I felt, I mean, I have ideas why it is that I felt different, but for whatever reason, you know, I would be plagued by this idea that I had to be somebody else, or I had to act a certain way for you to like me and for you to accept me. And that is a very, very tough way to live. You know, I would eventually do all the things I thought I needed to do to fit in and fix myself. And, you know, I was terrified of high school. I hated school so much. It made me afraid about failing. It made me afraid of not getting the right answers. I didn't like studying. I didn't see the point of school, and so I was terrified in school. So I was like, man, how am I going to get into high school? And all my friends seemed to like do fine at studying. And so, this is important because this is my brain, you know, kind of like before drinking, and like, you know, how I'm wiring myself and how society's, you know, society's influence is getting infiltrated and how I'm like beginning to think. And so I would think like that, and I was like, man, I'm not going to get into high school. This is going to be crazy. Like, I'm so dumb. And so this is going. You know, I ended up getting in high school, but I didn't get in the right high school. Then I was a really good basketball player and loved basketball, and my, you know, high school freshman team cut me. And then they were like, well, you should go to another high school. And so other parents were going to help me go to another high school to play on a good basketball team because they thought it was insane. And there's, like, politics involved because that's how, you know, the Catholic League is. It's, everything's just so much. And I was like, no, man, this is good. I'll stay where I am. And that was kind of the moment where, you know, we all, you know, I just know we all have this moment in our drinking where we kind of get, something happens externally or internally where the switch goes off and we're like, all right, I can kind of now live the way I want to live because I have a reason to, whatever it is. I've heard people talk about, like, you know, their parents died when they were young and like that gave them a reason to kind of flip the switch. And when I got cut from that basketball team, it gave me the reason to flip the switch because I was like, the one thing I loved, you know, shit, man. Oh my God, it's like making me cry. More than anything, I was just like, you know what, I'm not good enough. And so I'm playing that story in my head, I'm not good enough. These people are right. I shouldn't play basketball. And I was just like, well, I know what I'm going to do. And so I just start walking that road that we all walk. And I'm not walking that road to be bad. I'm just walking it so I don't have to think about how not good I am. And so I'm in college, and I kind of get some relief. And you know, I started playing lacrosse in seventh or eighth grade, and I was good at that. So ended up playing lacrosse, and that was fun. That got me, you know, that got me through high school, man, like having a sport to play. And senior year comes around, and I'm same predicament as I was in eighth grade. The next step is college. I'm terrified of college. I hate school. I had to get, you know, tutored for my SATs. And I end up, you know, getting into school, not because of my grades, man, because I had, like, a good coach and a good system. And I got, like I didn't fail. So I got, you know, I was able to go to school to play lacrosse. And at that time, I couldn't, like Bill talks about in his story, you know, the moment he arrived, you know, and I identify with that so much. And this is so sad, man, but, you know, I'm just being honest up here. Like, that was my arrival, man. Like, I peaked early. It was 18. Like, that was, like, my coming out party because I was fascinated. I thought so poorly of myself for a lot of other reasons, but those were the highlights. And my, you know, the narrator, the story I was telling myself was just so bad that I couldn't believe that they had let me into college and I was going to go play a sport. And I didn't even want to go. I couldn't voice that. You know, I think I probably told my mom, like, you know, college sucks. You know, I don't want to, you know, but part of me was like, I still want to fit in. I still want to look like I'm doing good and I want to do what my friends are doing. And I was so amazed that I got into college that the amount of relief I got and, like, happiness and, like, excitement that, like, you know, I was going to have, like, these teachers off my back for whatever, 3 or 4 months. You know, I'd got myself a girlfriend. And I celebrated by, you know, drinking, like, without a care in the world, you know, because I felt like, you know, no one's watching me anymore. Like, I'm done. Like, I'm out. Like, no school, no parents. My parents are happy I went to college. I got into a decent school. Like, I'll go play lacrosse. It'll be fine. And I just drank, and I got my first DUI. I was 18 years old. And my girlfriend at the time was, like, giving me a hard time about it. And I was like, what is your problem? Like, whatever, you know? And she is a sweet, nice girl. She's actually the valedictorian of my high school. How about that, you know? And very pretty girl and very nice and sweet. And I, you know, I wasn't like terrible to her. I wasn't nice to her. Like, you know, I would get her to drink with me. She wasn't a big drinker. And, you know, she did all that stuff. And she was super sweet and super nice. And I remember her giving me pushback for drinking. And I was like, this is crazy. And we would, she stayed here for school. And we would kind of ride out our relationship for 2 years. And I moved back and I tore that relationship apart because she interfered with my drinking. You know, I could not drink the way that I wanted to. And she was a keeper, man. She was a good one. And the way I broke up with her was horrible. You know, I think I got really drunk and like she came to try and talk and I just like wouldn't talk to her. You know, it was like crazy. And I like told her I was moving to Florida. And so, you know, I dropped out of college because when I got to college, man, I got removed from my safety net. And my safety net was living in this world of kind of like panic. Me and Timmy were talking about on the way up. Like I lived in panic and anxiety, man. But I had money, I had a job, I had a car, and I had a place to go, like my parents' house, and I can kind of do what I wanted there. And when I broke out of that, you know, that nest, and I went to college, I didn't have a car when I went to college, I didn't have a job. My job was to play lacrosse and study. And I didn't want to do those things, really, man. Like, I kind of want to play lacrosse when I wanted to, and I wanted to study, never. And they had me in study hall, and they had me doing all this stuff. And I freaked out. Like, I mean, I had a legit, like, you know, what doctors classified as, you know, whatever, you know, nervous breakdown or something because I couldn't handle it. And I didn't want to be there and I was away from home. So it's a mixture of, you know, all that stuff, homesick. But it's also, you know, it was also clear to me that I could not drink and I could not do what I wanted to do the way I wanted to do it. And what that says is it's just simple, man. It's like, selfishness and self-centeredness. Like that was like the root of it. Now sure there are some other things that stem from it, but that was it, you know, and I left that school. I had my dad come pick me up and I just didn't have the aptitude. I didn't have, you know, the courage. I didn't have the ability to be honest to tell them what was really going on. And what was really going on is like, I am so uncomfortable here because I can't live the way I want to live. And this is how I live, Dad. I'm terrified of school. I fucking smoke weed every day so I don't have to drink. And now I'm here and things aren't going well. But I didn't do that, man. I just freaked out. You know, I was just like, this is messed up, crying, all this. My dad drove up to, you know, Virginia Beach to get me. And this is critical, too. And this is how I would address that problem for the rest of my life until I got sober. He came up, took me to a doctor. The doctor was like, well, there's something wrong with the kid. He's having some anxiety, so here's some medicine for him. My dad said, good, we got the kid medicine. He can calm down. I'm here to pick him up. We go out to dinner. I take the medicine. It's like, you know, some Xanax or something like that to calm me down. I take that, and then me and my dad have a drink together. And that's my solution for the rest of my life. And I'm not mad at my dad for that or anything like that, but that is how I would approach it. So I would go see doctors, and I would just quit things and leave them, you know, until I came here. And that was it. And so that's the rest of my drinking. I tried things. I did them. I got uncomfortable. I got in trouble. I quit them. I went to a doctor. I took pills. And I started drinking again. And that was it. And in that, you know, term, in that span of, like, you know, I guess 8 years, I tried to do a lot of things. You know, I tried to do a career in golf. I tried to come back and get into real estate. Well, that's all I really did. It was just, it felt like forever, man. But I just failed at those things, you know, and I failed because my drinking and, you know, my thought process and the story I was telling myself just kind of took over. And so I couldn't do anything. I couldn't see anything through. And that just led for me being, you know, the happy kid that graduated high school that just wanted to go have fun and do all these things, to turn into a bad drunk man, like a bad alcoholic, you know, drinking, you know, by myself at night all the time. You know, the progression of the illness became a reality in my life, having to put something in my system just to be awake, hiding out in my parents' house at, like, you know, 26, 27, 28, and just continuously trying to apply myself, improve myself to the world, and I would fail, and I'd have to retract and start over, and I'd have to go hide. And the amount of shame I had, the amount of guilt, you know, it was just, I wasn't going to get past it on my own. And my second DUI was bad, man, and I was confused by it because I was on a lot of drugs. And it was the morning after. It was my I was 24 years old, and it was my 24th birthday that day. And I was so jacked up from the night before. I was like, I got to go get some medicine from the pharmacy because I had a script for my shrink because I just told you I saw doctors. And I got to get some weed so I can calm down because I'm going to go hang out with my parents, you know, and have dinner with them tonight for my birthday. And I hadn't slept all night. And I drove to the pharmacy, which is not too far from my house. And I drove to my buddy's house in Virginia to get some weed. And driving back home to, like, upper northwest D.C., like, not very far from where I grew up, like, about 2.5 miles, 3 miles from my house at 12 o'clock in the afternoon on my birthday, I just went to sleep behind the wheel, man, just out. I think I hit, like, 7 or 8 cars, like, all from behind, and woke up in the middle of the intersection with the paramedic handing me my sunglasses saying, are these yours? And I was like, yeah, they are. And I was like, this is bad news, man. And I, like, looked and saw that the joint I was smoking had burned a hole in my chest and my sweatshirt. I didn't care one bit about any of the people I hit, man. That was the last thing on my mind. I was like, where is the weed? Where are my drugs? I need to hide this, and I need to figure out how to get out of this. And I was banged up from that accident, man. You know, probably had a concussion. You know, my back was jacked up. I was driving an old S70 Volvo sedan. It was like a 98, built like a tank. You know, so it probably saved me. And that introduced me to rehab. And I basically incriminated myself because I wasn't drinking. I didn't fail a blow and go. But I knew what I did, you know. I knew that this was my fault. And I had a prescription in the car, but I somehow incriminated myself. Because, yeah, I just had to, you know what I mean? I don't know exactly what I said. And that would introduce me to, I go to jail for the first time. I go to rehab for the first time. Get the breathalyzer in the car the whole nine. And when I went to that rehab, it was outpatient. They told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not hearing it, man. I was like, listen, I'm just here to get out of trouble and get the breathalyzer out of my car. And just, you know, that's it. And get off these pills. I was addicted to some pills at the time. And so I do that. You know, they give me antabuse the whole nine. And about 30 days into it, you know, 30 days of not drinking and, you know, eating and sleeping, you sober up. And that, you know, that was about as sober as I'd been in my life. And I sobered up. And my response to sobering up was bad. I felt, it was basically all the stuff I was just talking to you about that I grew up with, this story in my head, this narrative, all that stuff became alive again, and it became well. And it was a new story about how I was going to fail again, and none of this was going to work, and everyone's fucking against you, and you're a loser, and all this shit. And I felt fat, and I felt disgusting. I felt like a loser. I'm at my parents' house. Why am I living there? All my friends aren't. I had to leave the house I was at with my boys. And so I just solved that problem by going to the doctor that I'm in rehab partially for, to get off the pills he gave me to get uppers so I can stop feeling that way. And that's how and I'm in a place where they want to help me, but that's how I respond to it. You know, so there's these layers of pride, there's this ego, there's this fear, there's all of it, and I have all that. And that was my response to that. And that would lead me down a road where I literally was seeing Jesus Christ, man, out of my effing mind, wackadoodle, psych ward shit. You know what I mean? Because I'm now taking these pills, and I'm trying to be sober. Like, I'm trying. So my idea to get better is to go to a doctor. Don't tell anyone how you're feeling. Get some, like, you know, speed from this guy. Take the speed so I can use it so I can fit into this mold that I think everyone wants me to fit into. And then I do that. But meanwhile, doing that, not being educated, I'm an alcoholic and how I'm differently, you know, I think differently from the neck up and how my body responds to this stuff. That leads me down this whacked up road. So I'm lying to everyone in my life. I lose my mind because the pills stop working, so I have to take more of them. And we take more of those pills, it messes up your brain. So my brain's messed up. I don't sleep. I now weigh 140 pounds. I'm no longer fat, but I'm losing my mind. My parents are terrified because I'm, like, saying weird-ass shit, man. I'm like, you know, God knows what I said to them. I feel terrible. I'm looking at people, and they're transforming before my eyes, and I end up in the Georgetown psych ward. And I go to the psych ward, and they start telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want anything to do with it. So I get out of the psych ward, and what do? I, you know, same thing I just told you I did. you know, I swear off alcohol. I'm like, let me go to the doctor again so the doctor can diagnose me with something, put me on some pills. I know the pills aren't working. I finally get it in my mind that, like, maybe I have a problem, and maybe these pills aren't the answer for me, and maybe I need to address the way I put things into my body, including alcohol. And I'm not an alcoholic at this point. So I get a job caddying. I'm only smoking weed. I'm taking my doctor's pills, and I'm trying to be a good kid. I'm trying to be a good son. I'm trying not to drink. Same thing happens. All the feelings come up, man. You know, because there's not enough. There's not enough marijuana in this world to block those feelings that I have of the guilt, the shame, the low self-esteem, the loneliness, you know, just the nonsense. It can't turn off the narrator, as I like to call it. And so something happens, and drinking becomes an option again immediately. And I start drinking again, you know, probably subtly. And I remember this one time that, you know, I was working, and I was working for, you know, an amateur golfer, and he was a, you know, high level amateur golfer, and he paid me. I made good money to caddy for him, and, like, you know, hot, you know, good tournaments, you know, like regional stuff and national stuff. And we went to a course to do a practice round. I played with him, and I was unhappy after the round because I didn't play well. I didn't score well at golf. And I had, you know, I had my medicine in the car, and I had my little one hitter. And I was like, man, this sucks. You know, this is, my life sucks. I can't even play golf good. You know, and this guy's out there, you know, to, one, make sure I'm, you know, he was a nice guy and, like, wanted to take me out, did something nice for me, took me to his club, and we were actually playing at that course. And so for me to get eyes on it, and I'm not thinking about his tournament round the next day that we have. I'm just like, all right, man, let's go get a drink after the round, because we went to, you know, eat some food, and I ordered a beer. And this is where it's like I knew things changed for me. Is because I wasn't a guy who, you know, like at 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, even 21 or 22, it was my relationship with alcohol is weird. It's like if I had too much anxiety, I couldn't even think about drinking because it would make me sick. That's how, like, jacked up I would get just by being alive. You know what I mean? So, like, that's why I would, like, kind of gravitate towards other things. And there's so much trauma from my drinking of getting caught all the time. Like, I just got caught all the time, so I'd be very selective. So, like, it's almost like I had to have this, like, perfect, you know, story set up and, like, place where I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And so it's just really weird relationship. But that, I started throwing that all to the side, and I became less picky as I got older, and I got unhappier, and I got angrier, and I got more lonely. And when I went out with this guy after the round, I ordered a beer, and then I realized this is a switch. I was like, a beer's not going to cut it, man. And that's when I started having these conversations. Like, I knew exactly what I was going for. And I was like, and this is the middle of the day, man. I don't care about what you think about me anymore. I feel so bad. I said, I'll have a Greyhound. In fact, I'll have two. And I had those Greyhounds, and it's a delicious drink. If anyone's never had one, it's grapefruit juice and vodka, and I had Grey Goose vodka with it, and it was fascinating. It was amazing. And I instantly felt better. Now, meanwhile, I'd just gotten the breathalyzer out of my car. And these drinks changed my life so much so that I decided that it would be nice if I ordered some Jaeger bombs at a country club with a bunch of, like, nice people. Like, there weren't, like, rugrats there, man. And so I'm doing Jaeger bombs on, like, a Saturday afternoon. And then everyone's looking at me. I know they're looking at me, but I don't care. I order a Greyhound to go. And I get to my car, or I get right, like, you know, the car's probably where that kitchen is, and I'm sitting there with my guy I'm caddying for the next day, and he's like, are you okay to drive? I said, I'm fine. And then I think about it for a second. I said, shit, dude, I just got this breathalyzer out of my car. I just pounded, like, two shots or Jaeger bombs. I've had three of these. I got one for the road. And in my mind, I go, well, it's August. It's the middle of summer here, or the end of summer. Most everyone's on vacation. It's still 5 o'clock out. I'll be fine. So that was my processing. That makes zero sense. There's no logic in that. But to me, it was totally logical. It was a total fine time for me to drive. And so I get in the car, and what happens is DUI number three. That leads me down the dark road, man. And the dark road where I'm drinking by myself. And all the, you know, the same story, you know. And I'm so paralyzed by fear. I'm you know, in the grips of alcoholism so tightly that when I go to I got money from someone else to go see a lawyer. They gave me $5,000. You know, third DUI where I'm from is, you know, jail time for sure. I'm not a jail guy. I don't know who he is, but like I just freaked me out, man. Like we're talking like 2 years, I think they were looking at sentencing me. So I go to the lawyer, I give him $5,000. Actually, I keep $2,000 that this guy gave me. Give the lawyer $3,000. I say, tell me what to do. I can't go to jail. He says, I need you to go to Avery Road, which is like a local rehab, because he knew I had no money. He's like, check yourself in for 28 days. You need to go to AA. He's like, get a job and just stop drinking. And I walk, and I just nodded my head. I said, okay. And he said, get court slip slide. I walked out of that lawyer's office, and I said, in the back of my mind, I said, I didn't pay you $3,000 to tell me to do that. And I just drank until my sentencing. And I got in some more trouble after that, caused a lot more damage with my family, and just hid and drank until that date. And, you know, luckily enough, because I paid that lawyer $3,000 and the lawyer was halfway decent, you know, instead of giving me 2 years, they gave me 3 months. No, they gave me 2 months, and I got out after 50 days, and I was home, you know, drinking again as soon as I got out of jail. And then I knew so-and-so, you know, prior to going in, and she was like, you should come to AA with me. And I was like, well, I'll go there to get you sober. And my plan when I was in jail, I was reading a lot of books. I read a lot of John Grisham, and I read this book called Born to Run, which is about this tribe in the copper canyons of Mexico who are like, you know, ultra runners, and they just fucking run, man. They don't even eat meat. They eat like rice and beans and eggs. And I was like, this is the way to live, you know, because I'm so disconnected from society now because I'm in jail. I'm not like the people I grew up with. You know, I'm this tortured soul. I was like, you know, when I get out, I'm just going to run and I'm going to eat rice and beans. And that's the first thing I did. And I realized when you get out of jail, you can't really run too far because you're basically in like 23-1, man. Like all I could do is like walk around the common area. And I ate some rice and beans. And then she told me to go to the meeting. And that's where that plan got defused. And I became introduced to the solution they talk about in this book. And that's, you know, so that day, June 2011, it's not my sobriety date. That's the day my life changed. And I was 28 years old. My 29th birthday happened October 22nd. And I would get my sobriety date January 16th of 2012. But during that time, I was fully active in AA, man. I just was so, you know, I would just relapse because I get so afraid and I couldn't be honest with someone. The good news about it is I was serious about not wanting to be the same guy I was. And despite my sincerity and my efforts, I came to find out that, you know, I need to be honest at all times, you know, despite my ego, despite my pride, despite my ideas, my expectations. And that's the key to sobriety, and that's the key to changing your life is having the courage, because it's the scariest thing you could possibly do is be honest. Like, let's think about it. You know what I mean? Like, tell someone the actual truth. Like, what am I actually thinking? Because, I don't know, man, but I was kind of, like, raised, like, on how to live. I had some pretty good examples in my life. I met some good people. I served Mass with Mother Teresa. Like, I was around a lot of positive influences. Like, I knew very successful people. But just because I knew them didn't make me successful. But I had an idea of how they lived their life. But despite... So, me not being like they are and not falling into that, you know, into that shape, you know, I judged myself. I was like, man, you shouldn't be thinking that. Why are you thinking that? You should be grateful. You shouldn't be afraid. You know, and so I couldn't verbalize these things. I couldn't communicate them. And you know, really, I probably wanted to communicate and verbalize that stuff at some point when I was like 4 years old. But, you know, I was, you know, afraid since I was then. So now I got to do that. I got to go back to where it all started, man, and figure out what it is I need to address. And that was big for me, is having the courage to, one, trust someone in this room. And that's a scary alternative. And I found a guy, and he would be my sponsor, and he did what he needed to do and helped me stay sober. He ended up leaving, and then I found my now sponsor today, a guy named Eric, and he's been my sponsor ever since. And you know, there's nothing special that we do, man. I just found a sponsor that I think, in my opinion, and I think it's critical for all of us, he has what I want, and what that is everything. You know, it's like everything. And obviously I've come to find out that he's a human being, and he's fallible, and he makes mistakes. He pisses me off sometimes. I think he could do better in certain areas of his life. You know what I mean? I have a couple suggestions for him. But... you know, really what we're working on, and when I asked them to be my sponsors. I need to find someone that did Alcoholics Anonymous and got it. Like, that's it. And I'm a guy who likes to go deep, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I want to learn about spirituality. I want to read other books other than what's in this, you know. I want to understand, you know. And he's awesome at that. And I found a guy that just did AA with me. Now, I'm happy to talk to anybody about anything. But when it comes down to sponsorship, when it comes down to someone like myself who is suffering from alcoholism, it doesn't need to be complex up front. It is clearly proven to me that it is my success is based on me taking actions over and over again that I didn't think would work and that I didn't want to take. But despite that, and it was like internal, man, it was bad. Like those panic attacks I talked about, you know, in college and all, I had that in AA for like 2 or 3 years because I was so afraid. I was terrified. But I wasn't afraid enough to just completely walk out on AA. But the interesting thing about Alcoholics Anonymous to me, which is so funny, you know, I know some people have been sober here for a while, and I think our experiences are the same to some degree, but I'm just going to tell you about mine, is, you know, I came here kind of in love with the theory because, as you know, I liked God. I thought God was cool. And I was like, all right, man, these people, they're not completely whacked, right? And then I started hearing about doorknobs, and you can make the group your higher power, and I was like, this is heresy. These people are crazy. They do not know the one Lord, true and save. You know, so I had judgments right away. And so I had all this conflict, but I was like, I kind of liked the idea, the breakdown of the steps. I was like, man, like, I can get on board with all of these. And then I got to 4 and 5, and I was like, all right, man, I did confession. I can do this. You know, I can write it down. And I can confess. And then we got to like 8 and 9, man. And I was like, dude, I don't know anyone amends. Like, I was just a nice guy who drank too much. And so that terrified me, but I kind of got through these steps. But long before I got to like 8 and 9, you know, doing 4 and 5 and getting this idea of, you know, the type of person I was, and my 4th and 5th step was not, you know, I hear awesome 4th and 5th step stories. Mine was awesome for me, but it's not like an awesome story. Like, I did not, you know, do this like searching and fearless. It was searching and fearless for that time in my life. It's as good as I could do. And it wasn't very long. It was honest. And it afforded me, you know, enough momentum to continue on with the steps and get to 8 and 9 and keep being sober. But I just did the best I could at that time. And I hated it. I thought it was the worst thing in the world. I felt like I was part of a cult. I really did. I was like, I don't think this is working. And so, you know, I just, it's going on still. You know, my mind is still telling me that stuff isn't going to work. But the one thing I had going for me was, I didn't have any other plan, dude. I don't know if you guys watch, like, I'm into, like, podcasts now. I'm into, like, anything that's, like, positive and uplifting that someone has said that teeters along the line of, like, going against yourself, I'll check it out. Because I'm interested in it. Because I'm a guy who wants to just hang out and be comfortable. If I could, I'd be retired. And I'd just play golf my whole life. And I'd be fine. And I'd cook dinner. I'd be nice to my fiance. Hopefully she'd be my wife and we would have a nice little life, you know, but I can't do that. I mean, I could like retire and like go, but I'm not going to, you know what I mean? There's stuff I need to handle. I got my mom and my brother. And so I'm just not there yet, but I don't want to work, man. Like it's like, like it goes against everything and like every bone in my body. Like I have this ridiculous case of entitlement. And so I have all these things I had to deal with in 4 and 5 and get introduced to here. But this is the tricky thing about AA is and the reason that I think any of us, the reason we found success in AA are these two reasons. One, even though it felt wrong to like our core being, meaning I thought this felt wrong to me in a lot of ways, I did it anyways. And the reason I could do that is I did not have a plan B. There was no plan B for me. Zero. It was like, this is going to work. Or I'm going to blow my brains out. That was it. And I think if anyone comes in and can have that kind of approach, and it doesn't need to be as extreme as blowing your brains out, but not having a plan B was helpful for me because it allowed me to investigate, ask the questions, do the work, and kind of come to my own conclusion about what was really happening here. And the way it worked for me, man, is I just wanted some money in my pocket. So I got no college degree. I just told you how I lived through my 20s. I had no resume. I had no driver's license. I had debt. I had nothing. So I'm coming out into the world at like as a fresh starting 29-year-old. You know what I mean? With like no, like I could talk to you, but that's it. I had no skills. I had no confidence. I had none of that. So I was petrified, man. And I had nothing to pour on top of it. You know, the only thing I could do was eat some chocolate every now and then. And then I was worried about that because I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be fat because I'm so vain. And you know, I should know how to be nice to myself. And so I was just like, listen, man, if I get money, if I end up getting a job, and I can get a decent salary, and I get a car, and I can get a little apartment, I was like, I will praise the riches of AA, and I will go preach the word on every mountaintop that I can see in my, you know, in my vision. I will buy into this. And what happened was before that even happened, before I got anything back, before I had, you know, paid off debt, before, you know, I started having moments where none of that shit mattered. You know, I could just hang out and be amongst people. And that's the kind of stuff I always overlooked. But it was huge because it kept me going on the next day. And sometimes it would keep me going the whole week. Sometimes it would keep me going the whole month. Because I was constantly comparing myself to you, to the rest of the world. And I could not accurately, you know, create value for myself. I was always, most of the time, just at the bottom. Complete loser, complete failure. You know, and I was never going to work out for me. And my idea of humbling myself was, you know, humiliation, it was degradation, it was, you know, it was bad. And, you know, sometimes, too, it's so funny with the alcoholic is I could also flip, you know, to walking around and being better than most people on that day with all the things I just talked about that I was so embarrassed about. So it's just very interesting, you know, dichotomy that we have going on here. But, you know, I somehow started... You know, I did the work, man, and that's cool, and I give myself credit for that. But I'm not, and people always say this, and I'd always get hung up on this. People would say, people do all these amazing things. I've heard so many amazing stories in AA, and people would say that AA, you know, this isn't me, and this is AA. And I kind of listen from my chair, like you guys are, and I'd be like, but you did the work, man. You know, like, if we're not here to be like, you know, complete, you know, like martyrs or like don't take any credit. And I didn't understand it for the longest time. And it's not that I want to give myself a pat on the back, but I perceived it as like, you know, something mysterious is happening here. Or I would perceive it as like, you know, I couldn't see the change. But, you know, now being, you know, removed from early sobriety and doing the steps and living life and trying to be a human amongst humans, man, trying to be an alcoholic amongst alcoholics, I understand what people are saying. And I am just not – the guy that I brought into AA was not capable of getting myself to where I am now without the help of the people in AA and the direction and the steps in the book. It just if I could have, I wouldn't be in AA. And so that's what people are saying, and that's what I'm saying when I say that, you know, AA is, you know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me because I couldn't get there, man, because I would. Like, I did not wake up in the morning and say, I want my mom to hate me, I want to terrify my parents, and I want my brother to, like, not want to hang out with me, so I'm going to go. I was like, and I couldn't even identify that I didn't feel good, man. You know, I was just like, I want to go have fun. You know, I couldn't even get down with that stuff. And... You know, the last 2 years has been amazing. And, you know, I get my car back. I get a job. The job finally gives me insurance. So now I'm like, oh, my God, I got insurance. I get a girlfriend, the woman I'm engaged to now. I still don't, you know, and I was dating her without a car, and that killed me for a little while. She would drive me around. But then one day I got used to it. I was like, this is nice. And you know, and I think that's the story, you know, of spiritual growth, whether it's you're in AA or you're doing something else, is that, you know, the moment we can accept it, the moment we can move on to something else. You know, and the moment I accepted that she was driving me around, man, my boss literally called like 5 minutes after I had that thought, maybe 30 seconds after. And he was like, listen, dude, this guy just rolled out. I had to fire him. Doors wide open. Like, I need you ASAP. And that meant more money. Like, that meant enough money for me to buy a car. And so it's weird how those things happen. You know, so I get my car. I get my little girlfriend. I get way more money than I initially had planned on getting, you know, because I just set the bar so low. And AA, you know, AA, you know, is fascinating. It's a very interesting place. I think it is, you know, there are mysterious parts of it. There are miracles here, and it is all very interesting. You know, so I get all that stuff and the stuff that I think that I need to, you know, and I'm the guy who's like, man, if I have these things, I'll be better. I'll be better at AA. I'll be a better, you know, boyfriend. I'll be a better son. I'll be a better this. And so I get all those things. I get, you know, more than I can handle, meaning not more than I can handle, but more than I need. And those things don't make me happy. How about it? You know what I mean? And, you know, the worst thing happened to me. I'm freaking out about buying my first car. I don't have a ton of cash. I got to buy it straight cash. I was like, I just got like $5,000 or $6,000 to spend on this car. It'll get me around for 2 years. And I'm just thinking in my head, like, what if I buy a lemon? What if I buy a lemon? What if I buy a lemon and it dies on me? Well, what happens? The car I buy dies on me, dude. Of course it does, because that's all I'm thinking about. You know, and do I not have another car? Am I broke? No, man, it's fine. Like, it always works out. You know, and I'm a big believer in the steps as a way to really completely change the way our brain functions. Bottom line. I'm a naysayer. I'm like, set the bar so low. Just give me the bad news first. Like, I'm not going to try anything. Because that way I'm prepared. And that way if something good happens, I can be excited about it and I can be overwhelmed, just like when I got out of high school. Like, oh my God. You know what I mean? But now it's different. And through the steps, you know, through inventory, through sponsoring people, through being sponsored, through going to meetings, through making mistakes, listening to speakers, asking questions, making friends in AA, hanging out with people who are doing the deal, you know, and most importantly, the steps and prayer, like all of them, you know, I think completely differently than the guy who walked in here. I don't have a ceiling on my life. I don't have a cap. You know, I really don't get too mad at people anymore. Like, I really don't. People don't embarrass me. People don't bother me, as much, you know, if I'm doing the stuff I need to do, and I can, you know, I can really kind of appreciate life on good days, you know, as it comes to me. And I had, you know, I kind of had the kitchen sink thrown at me. My fiance is coming here next week. If you notice, I didn't talk about her at all. She's the most beautiful and loving woman I've ever met. And she really is a sweet and beautiful, loving woman. But we, like anyone else, are working on our relationship, and we're constantly working on it. And that's what's cool about it, is I have like a sober woman in AA who has that approach. You know what I mean? Like, we are, there's no end game there. It's like, you know, we're merging, we're growing, we're going, and we keep going. So she's awesome. And she'll give a great talk next week. But, you know, she has, you know, and I'll speak for me on this. You know, she has a, like an autoimmune disorder, and it's pretty serious because it affects her lungs. So that's a scary thing. So she's got something going on with that. And then, like, I think before that happened, my dad gets immediately put in the hospital and is dead in 10 days because he's got lung cancer. Just like, boom, dead. And you know, and it was funny too, because I was calling my sponsor. I was like, hey man, I think I should probably make amends to my folks. And you know, the amends I had to make to my dad, he was on a ventilator. You know, he wasn't there. But it's interesting how that happened. And you know, I got to watch him pass, you know, to the other side, man. And you know, I got to go through all that, and you know, work's crazy at that time. I work in real estate, and it's the summer. When you're in real estate, like, that's how you eat, so you got to get deals done. And it's amazing what happens when you get to experience something like that, because all these things that, you know, are seemingly so important, all these people I needed to please and all the stuff I needed to do was not important anymore, to a fault, to where it could have got me fired because I could care less. You know, so it's interesting how you can appreciate that stuff. But my dad died April 13th, 2017, you know, and that's probably one of the greatest gifts I could ever gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I got to sit there and watch that man pass into, you know, what I've heard called is like greater consciousness and awakening, and that's what I believe. And he was a guy who, you know, I was embarrassed by. I thought he could be better. I had judgments of him. You know, I didn't like, you know, the way he was at times. And I got past all that, you know, before this happened, man. And I was able to get rid of those feelings, get rid of those judgments. You know, he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous shortly after I think his sobriety was before mine because, you know, I relapsed and it pissed me off. But anyway, you know, I got to speak for him at his celebrations, and I got to not be embarrassed by him anymore. And I got to appreciate him for the guy he was, and I got to give him money. And, you know, the coolest thing, chokes me up every time, is, you know, and I think we all have a truth that gets us in here. There's always, whether we know it now or not, there's something that's like pushing us to get sober, right? And what's behind that is God, you know, whether you believe in it or not. But there's like a story behind that. Like, you know, what is that story? And my story was this, and it's mixed with the good in me, it's mixed with the bad, it's mixed with my character defects, but I could not stand the idea of being a 30-year-old man and being a complete loser, meaning like I couldn't fend for myself. I couldn't take care of my parents if they got sick. I couldn't drive them to doctors if they got sick, because that's how I was, man. I had no license, no nothing. And I couldn't love them, and I couldn't accept them. And so that was like this driving force that pushed me in here. And it terrified me. I was like, shit, dude. It's like 3 years. I'm sober. I still don't have a car. I still don't have money. I still got to pay off my debt, and I'd worry about my parents. And, you know, so sure enough, like the year before he passed, you know, I had enough money, and I got to take them, get them a beach house in North Carolina for a week and take them to my cousin's wedding to celebrate there. I think it was her 40th wedding anniversary. And, like, I mean, dude, I want money. You know, I want recognition. I want all those things. I want approval. You know, I still struggle with all those things. But, you know, the joy and just, like, the freedom you get in that of, like, you know, and that's, like, the one thing I asked, man. You know, from AA, I was like, just like, don't let me be this loser kid, you know? And it gave me them, you know, it gave me that, you know, times a million, dude. And I can't repay that. And so there are times in my sobriety, and there are times, I think, in all our sobrieties where, you know, and I'll speak for me that I, you know, I'm like, shit, dude, AA again? I got to go to AA? Like, I feel pretty good. I'm eating right. I'm praying. I'm running. I'm meditating. I'm nice to people. My relationship with my fiance is good. I'm helping my mom out. But, you know, life happens. And so real quick, dude, after my dad died, you know, Maggie's in the hospital with, like, lung shit. It's just, like, it's mess. You know, my dad just passed. I'm at the funeral. We pay to bury my dad, which is awesome. Like, you know what I mean? I'm just, like, so happy I could help out and do all that stuff. You know, Maggie gets sick, and she's sick, and that just wears on you. It just does. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're a saint. That shit wears on you. And so it's hard. And if you don't talk about it with someone and you don't navigate those waters, it comes out sideways and it's all weird. But, you know, so I get through that. And then my mom has a stroke in May of 2018. You know, luckily luckily she can move, but she lost her business. So she doesn't have a car. She can't drive anymore. She can't work. And so I'm dealing with that. And it's, you know, and I relate to her because what she's going through is like the loneliness of alcoholism. You know, when there's a loss, alcoholism, like getting rid of alcohol, man, and changing my life, there's a major loss there. So this is a woman who lost her vision. She can't drive anymore, can't support herself, lost her husband. She's got loss. You know what I mean? So I'm dealing with that. And so life just comes at you. And who's the guy I want to be? I want to be unfazed. You know what I mean? And how do I remain unfazed for life? I come in these rooms. I try my best to have a sense of humility, have a sense of gratitude, a perspective. And appreciate the life that I've been given and the opportunity to show up for these things. You know, because it's hard. It's hard to keep going. It's hard to keep going when you think life is good. And it's easy for me to think life is good. But I'll tell you this. There, you know, I looked up to the guys who were sober longer than I was. I looked up to the guys that kind of – that did this but also did it out there. You know what I mean? They had jobs. They had companies. They had families. They, you know, I know this one guy, John. I love him to death. He's going to be at my wedding. You know, he moved his mom to his house while she died of brain cancer, man. Like those are the guys. And you want to know what else those guys did? Those guys drove me around and picked me up, like, all the time when I was new. And so, you know, if I think about what I'm trying to get here, right, because that's just how I'm wired. Like, what can I get? What I'm trying to get is this. Like, I want the spiritual awakening. I want God. I want all that stuff. But if I'm really looking at it, what I'm trying to get is I want to know what those guys have, that they can live such a full life, that they can do all these things, that they can make money, that they can help their families, that they can be kind, and that they can still somehow find it, you know, in their day and their life to continuously give it back to people like me. Wouldn't I be a fool if I missed out on that? And that's the thing, man. You know, can I stay here long enough, and can my eyes and can my heart become open enough to when I see how Maybe you don't die if you leave AA and you got what you're hearing and you never drink again. I'm not even saying you're going to die. But I think my heart may be a little more lonely, and I may be in a little different place if I didn't do this. You know, and so that's what keeps me coming back, man. I want to figure out, you know, and keep practicing how to do that, because that's where the magic happens, you know, because those guys did it for me, and you know, it's a blessing that I get to do that for other people. So that's what we're doing here. That's it. We are just trying to help somebody else, man. And, you know, it happens when it's supposed to happen, but the only way I can help someone is if I show up. So I'm happy that I could show up here tonight. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts on, like, how good it is to get out in nature and how it can actually change, like, how you are. And so I was talking to Billy about hikes. So I'll be back hiking the old rag. What's the other one called? White Rock?
White Oaks,
yeah. So it was, and I got to come up here with my friend Timmy. It was nice. Hopefully we'll catch a little sunset, hold hands, listen to some music on the way home, and, talk about AA. But you guys are super nice and super attentive, so thanks so much for listening.